Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy any investment based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research. The Sunday Roast presents 12 stocks for the 12 days of Christmas. Merry Christmas, everyone. Thank you for listening.
Welcome to the 12 stocks for the 12 days of Christmas. We're joined by Sapang Ai, CCO of Sovereign Metals. Merry Christmas, Sapang. Welcome back.
Merry Christmas, Phil. Good to be back.
2023 has been quite the year for Sovereign Metals, with a PFS completed, strategic investment of circa 40 million Aus dollars from Rio Tinto for an initial 15% shareholding, with options to increase to circa 20% within 12 months, and graphite downstream test work confirming the superior crystallinity and purity of Casilla's natural graphite. Just talk us through how pivotal this year has been, please, Sapan.
This year has been pretty crazy for us. Look, we started in January putting out some resource infill drilling results to get our resource up and ready for a PFS later in the year. Those drill results were coming back with, 5% graphite, 1.5% rutile, big grades for something that's so shallow, so easily mineable, so easily processable. So after January, we got into March. I think I've spoken about the ESG benefits or decarbonization benefits of Casilla quite a few times with you guys. But look, in March, what we did was we actually put some numbers around the graphite. And what does it mean to produce graphite from Casilla versus produce graphite from anywhere else, including our peers and China, where most of the natural graphite comes from, in terms of actual carbon emissions? And look, lo and behold, an independent peer-reviewed survey came out with Casilla's graphite would be the lowest amongst anyone else in the world. I mean, 0.2 tons of CO2 emissions for every ton of graphite you're producing out of Casilla. The next lowest would be twice that. And most of the graphite that comes out is from China, and there's something like 1.2 tons of CO2 for every ton of graphite produced there. So really good numbers there. Heading into April, we increased our indicated resource by 80% after that infill drilling was built into the resource model. That was great because it gave us quite a big mining inventory for the PFS that we started working on. By June, we had shown the market that our graphite had great suitability for the lithium ion battery sector. Two of the key components you need for any graphite to end up in a battery are purity and crystallinity. Crystallinity is basically all about how electrically conductive is this graphite in a battery. And we put out that announcement showing that we hit, if not surpassed, all those benchmarks. After that, we started a graphite bulk sample operation to start putting that graphite out of Casilla out to a lot more end users. Then July came along, and look, we announced our biggest announcement to that point, which was Rio's investment of $40 million, which you alluded to. They've become a 15% strategic investor, so they're an actual shareholder of Sovereign Metals. It's not a JV structure, much like sometimes some of the majors do. They're an investor and they want to see us progress and do well. Some of the nice caveats that came with that deal were Rio has a right to 40% of the offtake. They did a lot of work on the rutile and the graphite. Clearly they loved both, or at least it ticked a lot of their boxes. We've set up a technical committee, and that $40 million will work towards getting a DFS done next year. And then by September, we put out a PFS on Casilla. And that PFS basically was what I like to call the end of the beginning for Sovereign Metals. So it was, what can Sovereign Metals stand alone with no input from Rio Tinto? What could it achieve with a project, a gigantic project the size of Casilla? And what we figured out was, well, if we were able to spend $600 million of CapEx, we could get a 25-year mine, which will be throwing off $400 million of EBITDA a year. Yep. So that's pretty impressive. And by the way, by the end of those 25 years, you'd still have 70% of the resource to go. And then look, when we had Rio on board, we had a PFS done, we're moving into this phase of working with Rio to better understand, you know, what's the real potential of Casio? It's the biggest rutile deposit in the world. It's the second biggest graphite deposit in the world. It's clearly got the potential to be the lowest cost producer in both those critical minerals and the lowest CO2 producer in both those minerals. It's world scale. It's tier one. You know, we started building a team around it. So that's technical team. We had a new CEO join us. That was Frank Eager, who's got a background in developing businesses and mining projects in sub-Saharan Africa. And then look, we've ended the year upscaling our graphite program for the lithium-ion battery space after that news came out of China that they'd be banning certain exports of natural graphite. So all in all, it's been a very busy 2023 for us.
Very good, Seppan. I mean, there has been a huge amount happened. And I suppose the question I pose to you is, what price did Rio come in at?
So they came in at just under 49 cents on the ASX.
Which in translation to the UK price would be what?
About 25, 26p.
Okay. So right now, you have the ability to come in at a price under what Rio Tinto spent to come in on this project. So I think that's firstly a very important point, and I suppose makes us look at the share prices movement overall. I mean, at one point you were more than double the share price that you are now on expectation. Now it's become a reality, and if you like, we're on the cusp of that curve now that goes back up to those valuations. And from the point of view of Rio taking a position in any of these smaller mining companies, tell us what is the normal outcome of these situations?
Well, look, Rio doesn't go in and operate mines on behalf of small companies, right? They've got a wider approach, and it's the deal with Rio was really spurred on by Rio's exploration team, who are basically mandated to go and find projects out there that will move the needle for a Rio Tinto. So they've got to be large scale. They've got to be in critical minerals. They've got to have an element of, you know, decarbonizing the planet. They've got to be really long life, and they've got to be, you know, have superior economics to really make it worthwhile for shareholders and for Rio as a corporate to invest in. Now they've invested $40 million, which isn't, you know, isn't chump change. And they've got an option to actually increase to 19.9%. For that extra 4.9%, they'd pay in around $16 million extra dollars. So, you know, for a junior, that's a lot of money. For a company of our size, that's a decent chunk of change. Obviously, for Rio, it's a different category. But
what price is that effectively coming in at then?
That option is strikeable at a 10% premium to their original investment price. So that's around 53.5, 54 cents. So in pence terms, you're talking about
28, 29p, something like that. Yeah.
To be honest, it was a very interesting. I saw a video this week, actually shared it on X, and it was Dave Andrews, head of exploration at Rio, who was actually mentioned the Casia rutile deposit as well. So it was really good to, you know, they're not just coming to this and putting it on the back burner. It's still very much at the forefront of their minds. They're actively talking about it at these seminars that they attend. You know, as you say, they're there. And also, as you rightly said there, when we were in Rwanda, we met some of the Rio guys who are moving into new countries and new jurisdictions, Rwanda, to invest in these new metals, lithium, for instance. I mean, we only had in the news last week that ExxonMobil have actually moved into lithium now. So it's the new oil with all these sort of plays like the rutiles, titanium oxides, etc., and graphites. They're all there, aren't they, for the decarbonisation? So very much at the forefront right now.
Yeah, and it's not just at the corporate level. It's the political, you know, push and the policymakers who are driving a lot of this. You can imagine that as miners, everyone's now getting inbounds or at least making contact with a number of governments around the world, specifically a lot of the governments outside of China who are putting together, you know, mineral security partnerships, trying to figure out security of supply of these critical minerals that are going to hit everything from, you know, the aerospace, defense, automotive, decarb, anything and everything. I mean, even consumer electronics, you know, with iPhones being made out of titanium these days, it's not a bad gig for us to be the largest rutile deposit in the world.
Tell me what could go wrong here, Seppan, because I'm listening to you, and I have actually listened to you all year saying these things, and we've been sort of waxing lyrical about the why the share price is where it is. You've got an NPV of in the billions, basically. I think it's 2.5 billion or maybe more. It would be more.
1.6 billion on an 8% WACC. So yeah, 1.6 billion.
And then a post-tax IRR of 28% as well.
Yeah. And that NPV is post-tax as well, right?
Okay, so we've got 1.6 billion NPV. That's the titanium and the graphite, or that's okay. Just one of them?
Yeah. Correct. And what we'd be is we'd be a 50% of our revenues would come from the rutile, the titanium, and 50% from the graphite. So be under no illusions. Whoever is running, owning, producing from Cassia is the biggest player in the high grade, low CO2 titanium industry. Full stop. Not only
that. So they're going to be able to get a premium for what they sell for sure.
Yeah, but not only that, because of the graphite, and we've always called it a byproduct or a co-product. I mean, look, it's the second largest graphite deposit in the world. It'll be the lowest cost graphite deposit in the world, and it'll be the largest producer of flake graphite in the world. So you would be a fundamental piece of the lithium ion battery industry.
Okay, so playing devil's advocate. It seems like an absolute no-brainer. What can go wrong?
Look, there's always risks between kind of PFS and production, which is why we do things like the DFS and lots of technical studies in between. But we know where the high-risk categories, or they're not even high-risk, they're the riskier categories. It's not the geology, it's not the technical stuff. That's all very, very simple, very easily understood. It's going to be more so, you know, What's the optimum way to configure this project, just given the scale of it? Do we start in the north and go south? Do we start in the south and go north? Where do we put the plant? We've got so many options. It's just figuring out exactly what is the best way of doing it. And, you know, to be honest, when you've got a project the size of 5 Manhattan Islands, it's a lot easier to do those and mitigate those risks with a Rio Tinto by your side, rather than, you know, a few of us here in London and Cape Town trying to do it.
So there isn't any risks.
I think that's another way of saying it.
I would say that.
I think people have to understand that this project has now come to a point where Rio is also involved. There are risks, for sure, but a risk that this whole thing just blows up when you've got the president of Malawi also sitting around and saying, you know, well done, guys, you found this and it's going to go to market. What I really want to know is, what is the inflection point that's going to make this worth 1x, 2x, 3x, 4x its current value? Yes, we can turn around and say a discounted net present value, which is what it says, the net present value, what it's worth today, is $1.6 billion. Now, nobody's going to pay the net present value, because that's not how these things work.
Is it out the question that it could get to the value of the annual EBITDA at $450 million? I mean, I know that's the sort of thing we're looking at.
I mean, just on that point, Phil. Look, what do major mining companies trade at? They trade at an enterprise value of 4.5 to 5 times their average annual EBITDA. You know, that's always a good indicator of what an asset could look like in the future.
Okay, so that's a good way to look at it from a valuation point of view. Now, there's no way Rio are ultimately going to pay that, because they have to add to their bottom line. But 1x, 1.5x, 2x annual EBITDA of, as Phil said, $400 million is not beyond the bounds of possibility in this particular scenario. Is that fair to say, or are we just talking crap? Excuse my French.
I'd never say you're talking crap, Kevin, but...
I do. People tell me quite often, actually.
No, yesterday, wasn't it, that I said it?
Yeah.
But what are we trading at? You know, a couple of years away from FID, a few years of construction into production. You know, today, what are we trading at? Have a look at that. And it's, you know, 0.2, 0.3 times our EBITDA. That's what...
Yeah.
That's literally three or four months of EBITDA is our market cap.
Yeah. Crazy.
Yeah.
Let's look at the, we've already talked briefly about the sort of the logistics of it. Let's look at the, you talked low CO2 footprint. We've also in the past talked about hydro mining and how easy it is to actually mine this product. And CO2 emissions, very low, as you said, planned operations. You've got, was it zero strip ratio and low reagent? Do you want to just talk through how important that is about the strip ratio as well, Supan?
Yeah, look, what do you do with a normal, whether it's, you know, hard rock or semi-soft rock or, you know, even some soft rock projects out there, what do? To liberate those minerals in there, you've got to drill it, you've got to put some explosives in there, you've got to blast it, you've got to then load and haul all those bits of rock into yellow kit, take it to a machine where it gets crushed down, and from that machine then it gets put into mills where it gets ground down into effectively sand. Or, you know, so the thing about Cassia is it's pretty much similar to sand right now as it sits, right? It's a very soft, friable deposit. So we're looking at hydro mining, which means a high powered water jet, just an industrial scale hose pipe, right? Pointed at this stuff on the ground, and it just mixes in with the water and creates this slurry that then just gets pumped straight to a processing plant. And now imagine a processing plant. And what are you thinking when you think of a processing plant where you've got to liberate these minerals from this water? You know, are you thinking big furnaces and, you know, or smelting and all that kind of jazz, lots of acids and waste materials and all this? None of that exists with ours. It's very conventional, very simple stuff that's been worked on in the heavy mineral sands industry for donkey's years. And what's that? Rutile is a heavy mineral. So when you spin it round a spiral, it liberates itself from everything else. So we're easily able to capture that rutile by just putting it through gravity separation, right? The heavier stuff comes out from the lighter stuff. Now that lighter stuff is full of graphite. So we may as well take the graphite out. And we do that by sticking it in a flotation tank where graphite, because of its density, essentially just rises to the top in these tanks, and we're able to skim it off.
So within this friable material, you have literally got the rutile and the graphite existing together, and you can just separate them off pretty, it's a very simple processing technique.
Correct. I mean, there's no new tech or high tech or anything, you know, any kind of theoretical possibilities or things that we've got to, you know, kind of do PhD style studies on to liberate these minerals. Yeah. I mean, it's been done for years, and we'll just continue doing it in the same vein.
And low reagent usage, presumably, at that point.
Yes, the only reagents are going to be to use in the flotation.
Yeah, okay.
And by the way, everything that's left over once we've liberated those minerals, i.e. the tailings, yes, there'll be a tailings dam, but we will put back as much material as possible back in those pits. And because of the size of these pits, we're not going very deep, right? These are kind of, on average, 12 to 13, 14 meters deep. So we can rehabilitate the land, put the material back, make it ready for farming, agricultural, whatever use it was before. We could do that in kind of the space of 5, 6, 7 years.
So remediation works pretty simple as well. Okay. So the next stage is 2024. You've got the optimization phase, and then you're going to move to the DFS with Rio. So just talk us through what potential shareholders and listeners can look forward to in 2024.
Yeah. So look, we announced the graphite bulk test work. Obviously, that graphite will go to a number of labs and end users. We'll get the answers to many questions about what this graphite looks like in certain types of batteries. We're talking to a number of end users of both titanium and graphite. So, you know, look out for anything there. You can imagine if we're one of the largest producers and lowest cost in both of those minerals, that everybody and anybody is interested in talking to us. And then having Rio there, you know, we are a junior mining company, right? No doubt our market cap is bigger than many of the guys on AIM, but our project is multiply larger than many of the guys on AIM, right? But still, it takes a lot of management time and effort to figure out where do we fit within the ecosystem of titanium and graphite, and who are our end users, and what do those value chains and supply chains look like? It's a lot easier to get the answers and do all that work when you've got a Rio Tinto who has 50 odd thousand people across 35 countries and has 2,000 customers already.
Yeah.
Because we just tap into that.
Absolutely. And you've also got the significant socio-economic benefits, you know, fiscal returns, you've got the job creation it brings as well, skill transfer, and obviously also community development within Malawi. So it's a win-win, really.
Yeah, look, it's we talk about, you know, we've talked quite a bit about the project and the corporate side and the value creation and all that kind of good stuff. But the real value creation of a project this size, it's almost global, yeah. Right? And it's so important for Malawi that this project gets up and running. It's one of the poorest countries on earth. It gets a lot of its money just from foreign aid, from the US, from UK, the EU, from Japan. And to start building an industry in that country that will make it a lot more self-sufficient, bring in a whole load of jobs. You know, we're talking 1,000 direct jobs during the construction phase alone for us. But you've got all these indirect jobs, right, that will all exist around Kassia. I mean, for us, it's a no-brainer that we just go ahead and kind of do this as fast as possible.
Good. No, it all sounds very positive, and we look forward to you updating the market in the coming months and obviously into 2024. So obviously, being a Christmas-themed podcast, my question to you is, what is the typical traditional Christmas in the Guy household?
So usually, it's one of three places. It's usually everyone gets together at our house, or they get together at the family home, which is my parents' house, or if we're unlucky, we end up at the in-laws.
Yeah, I hope your in-laws don't listen to this.
Yeah.
That
part? No. The only
I will send this to your wife somehow. And tell her to listen. It might be your last Christmas.
But what food? Come on, give us the food. What are you going to eat?
Let me caveat that with the fact that my in-laws are lovely people. but they're vegetarian. So
okay, it's the food thing. So what are you going to eat?
So look, if it's at ours, big turkey, chicken, lots of red meat flying around, all the trimmings, just the whole lot, right? And you just sit there and you just guzzle it all up until you can't anymore, washing it down with copious amounts of beer and wine.
Brilliant.
Very good. My questions are about Christmas is, what is the most exotic, strangest, unpredictable place that you've ever spent Christmas in?
Well, I did at one point. I used to work for a South African bank, and I was based in Joburg during Christmas. And it's very, and obviously it's their summer during that time, so it's very weird walking in, you know, 35, 40 degrees heat. And you look in the shop windows and there's a Santa covered in snow. Just
we talked about this, didn't we, on the other one. We were saying that I can't get my head around being on a beach on Christmas Day, being in the Southern Hemisphere. But as you say, it must be novel.
And and I'm not sure walking around Joburg is very a good idea either, because it's not a very safe city, is it? Let's be honest.
There's some areas you'll be fine.
When we were in Joburg this year, earlier this year, I think that was the unsafest I've felt, to be honest, wherever we've traveled.
Well, we were in the safety of Sandton, man. That was safe. It's when you go to Soweto and place, or even downtown Joburg, it's just edgy.
Yeah, well, when the hotel says, please don't walk outside, it sort of tells you something, doesn't it? Shall we walk to this restaurant or get a taxi? It's like an armored vehicle would be probably the best option, you know? So, yeah, no criticism of South Africa as a whole, but Joburg itself seems to be not very safe. But anyway, thank you for your time. And it's been great chatting to you throughout the year. And we look forward that 2024 will be a moving year and a prosperous year. I think the markets have started to change, and you undoubtedly have value in your proposition. I mean, the numbers speak for themselves. So let's see if people take that up.
No, thank you, gents. Thank you for the time to just go through the story again with your listeners, and wishing all your listeners happy holidays.
Guy, CCO of Sovereign Metals, thanks very much for your time.
This podcast was brought to you by Roast PR Limited. If you would like to appear on a future episode of The Sunday Roast, please email admin@thesundayroast.net.